Right. Good evening, everybody. Stephen Roach is one of Wall Street's most influential economists. He's managing director and chief economist of Morgan Stanley, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him here this evening. He's been writing in recent years on globalization, China, productivity, capital market implications of global imbalances, and various other things. He was a research fellow at the Brookings Institution long ago before moving to the research staff of the Federal Reserve Board in Washington, and later became vice president of economic analysis of Morgan Guaranty before joining Morgan Stanley. It is a great pleasure to have him talking this evening, and I'm going to give him the floor without further ado.
Thank you very much, John, and thank you all for coming. I've been hooked on this idea that you need to look at the world economy holistically for some time, a rather obvious outgrowth of globalization, and that sort of led me to studying the concept of the balance or lack thereof in the world economy, and I'm struck by an awful lot of lack thereof in assessing the frictions that have emerged, at least in a macro basis, across borders and across markets. My sort of theory is a little bit sort of an economist attempting to borrow from physics the idea that if a system is balanced and in a fairly stable shape, it is able to withstand the periodic shocks that often afflict heavenly bodies and economies, and when it is unbalanced, it is less capable of withstanding the periodic blows that often occur. It still seems to be a reasonable structure to me, but last year was a rough year for those of us on the global rebalancing watch. You know, all the things that were supposed to happen did not, may have been a bad year, or it may, as many of my critics have said to me, the beginning of the end. We have you have to look at the world differently. Globalization works in new and different ways than you old-timers think it does, and it's appropriate to begin to modify your theories as well as your metrics. I must confess, without sounding too cynical, this is precisely the response I heard when I was on the other side of the great NASDAQ bubble of 1999 and 2000. And many of the same individuals who were boasting of the new paradigms back then are leading the charge of the new paradigms of globalization. But that doesn't mean they're wrong. It just means that some of these feelings that we're seeing do strike a familiar chord in a relatively short period of time. I'm here to warn you tonight, though, that I'm not backing down. Just because the dollar rose rather than fell last year, after having fallen for 2 years in a row, I might add, doesn't mean that we can ignore ever mounting global imbalances. And just because the U.S. was able to fund its massive, unprecedented current account deficit last year by the funds from increasingly desperate Asian central bankers doesn't mean that we can ignore global imbalances. And just because long-term interest rates, real long-term interest rates, stayed low last year also does not mean, that's me. Just because real long-term interest rates stay low doesn't mean we can ignore global imbalances. I think, ladies and gentlemen, that we're really at a point here of close to maximum danger. I think there are two sets of forces that are now coming into play in this holistic global framework that I look at, and I'll take you through them. One is the sustainability of imbalances from a fundamental point of view, and that's a case that rests on the back of the spending-addicted American consumer. And secondly, is sort of psychology, this degree of complacency that is building daily in our financial markets, with investors around the world believing that there's little, if any, risk to stocks, bonds, or currencies in this construct. And I think that this confluence of the worrisome fundamentals and the psychological underpinnings of complacency is an exceedingly dangerous combination. So let me take you through some of the graphs we have here and try to make my case. And then you will have ample opportunity to do as others have done, including this morning at Chatham House, to try to convince me that I'm wrong. So let me see if I can. Okay, let's just start here with just some simple metrics that lay out the disparity that's opened up between nations with current account surpluses on the top and deficits on the right. The first thing we've done on the left is scaled both the surpluses and deficits. They should add up to the same, but because of accounting issues, they don't. And the disparity between the two has never been larger. What's particularly interesting, though, is the asymmetrical distribution of the surpluses and the deficits. The surpluses are all pretty widely diffused among many, many major countries of the world. The deficits, of course, are not. One country, the United States, accounted for 70% of all the world's current account deficits last year. You'd have to sort of put about 11 countries in the top to add up to 70% of the total. And this is an important chart because it also gives you a key as to why this problem could get worse in the years ahead. I'll show you shortly why I think the U.S. current account deficit is going from bad to worse as we speak. But policies in the three largest current account surplus countries, Japan, Germany, and China, are currently aimed very much at trying to stimulate their internal demand. If those policies are successful, that would result in a reduction of their surplus savings, reductions of their current account surpluses, having less capital to send America's way to fund its deficit. And the question we've been asking all along is not whether America can keep funding its current account deficit. We believe that will be the case, but the question is at what price? And so as the big surplus nations of the world begin to reduce their surplus saving and have less of it to send their way, the pressure on the United States to make some concessions in terms of the dollar or real interest rates will only grow. Now, it's a totally different way to look at the world, but it starts to get at some of the more near-term forces at work in driving these imbalances and in creating some of the so-called symbiotic relationships between two of the world's key economies right now, China and the United States. I show you here the Chinese producer is emblematic of the main engine on the, that's not me. See, everybody has these Blackberries, it's just horrible. China is the main engine on the supply side of the global economy, and we show you here a year-over-year growth in industrial output. And the American consumer is the main engine on the demand side. We show you here the U.S. consumption as a share of its GDP. The point is, there are lots of other pieces in the global economy, but if you had to sort of isolate the two dominant forces at work in the global economy today, this would be it. And they're very much related to one another, as I will show you shortly, especially when you recognize that China's export-led growth dynamic is heavily dependent on selling goods to the American consumer. Roughly 35 to 40% of all Chinese exports go to the United States. Both of these measures have gone to excess. Chinese industrial output growth is still if you believe these numbers, and I think they're fairly accurate in this case, rising in excess of 16.5% year on year. The Chinese have made periodic efforts, which have failed, to slow down the growth of an overheated economy. And I'll come back to this in a second, because I think China is now at the point where this growth rate is truly unsustainable in terms of the forces that are driving it. And so the need, not necessarily to slow the economy down, but to shift the mix of the Chinese economy, is increasingly urgent and is an issue being actively discussed right now in Beijing. The American consumer, though, as I said at the outset, this is the potentially the weakest link in the global growth chain. You can see what consumers are doing here. After 25 years of running consumption at roughly 67% of GDP, we're now at 71%. We've been there since early 2002. In the final stages, addiction begins to take you over, and suffice it to say, that is in the mindset of the American consumer right now. This is a spending binge that is unhealthy because it's not supported, in my opinion, by the internal income-generating capacity of the U.S. economy. If there were good, solid income underpinnings to this consumption binge, I would say, well, maybe we deserve to spend this much because we're spending what we earn. That is not the case. And you can see here, this is a proxy for the labor income that is generated by our labor markets. We call it private sector compensation. These are basically wages, salaries, fringe benefits like Social Security, medical care, disability insurance. It's the broadest measure of compensation we have in the private economy. It's the biggest piece of personal income in the United States. This particular concept accounts for about 65% of total personal income in the U.S. And I show you here a couple of lines. The current cycle is the solid line, and then we've averaged out the preceding cycles that lasted this long as the dashed line. And no matter when you set the index equal to 100, where you measure it, this has been the weakest recovery in modern U.S. economic history for the earned labor income in inflation-adjusted terms. In just the last year, the growth rate, as you can see, is very flat. In real terms, it's up about 2.5%. At this phase in a business cycle expansion, the 2.5 should be at least 3.5. The cumulative shortfall between the two lines, as the little box indicates, is close to $400 billion U.S. dollars, roughly 5% of real disposable personal income. Why? I'll come back to this. To me, it's an outgrowth of a very powerful global labor arbitrage, one of the principal characteristics of globalization. This is a labor market recovery that initially was jobless, and increasingly is wageless in the sense that there's been an unusual stagnation of real wages, even in a rapid productivity growth environment. So a lot of analysts of the United States have said all along, well, this is a temporary development, and you know, it's fine to support the economy by tax cuts or other extraordinary measures, but one of these days, you know, the labor market's going to come back and take over and deliver the old-fashioned way. 48 months later, it's time enough to say that, wait a second, this is a lasting feature of the current environment that may not easily fade and restore itself to previous historical vigor. So you have this chart, which in a standard Keynesian consumption model would give you a significant shortfall in discretionary consumption. And yet, as I just showed you on the right, you have this type of consumption outcome, the strongest share of consumption in recorded history. How do you close the loop on this? Obviously, the income economy is out. Welcome to the brave new world of the asset economy. Americans have now figured out that it's perfectly fine to extract equity from asset holdings, initially by doing it through some psychological tricks during the equity bubble of the late 90s, but now getting down to utilizing the latest in financial technology to simply monetize or extract equity from homes. American consumers have become convinced that asset inflation has now qualifies as a permanent and sustainable source of savings. So once you've made that leap of faith to buy into the basic construct of the asset economy, that this appreciation is for real, why should you save out of income? And of course, Americans do not do that anymore. On the right is the income-based personal savings rate published by the U.S. Commerce Department. Last year, it fell deeper into a negative territory than at any point since 1933. This is the London School of Economics. I'm sure you're keen students of economic history. You will recall that was not one of America's better years. The problem with the model of the asset economy is the notion that asset inflation is believed to be a permanent, sustainable, and enduring a source of saving, and that is the big challenge for the asset economy. And it gets challenged from time to time, as it did in 2000 and 2001, 2002, by post-bubble shakeouts. So if you don't have asset bubbles, it's fine. But when you do have asset bubbles and you're betting the ranch, as we say in the U.S., on the asset, you can get into trouble. On the left, you can see America's rate of house price inflation for us. Now, it didn't get as bad as it did here, but it's a record for us, at least in the last 27 years since this data have been collected. Running still, it's down a tiny bit from the second quarter high of about 13.5% down to about 12.25%. And I hear a lot from central bankers, especially one who's about to step down in about 10 or 11 days, who says, look, you can't look at nationwide house price indexes in a property market as fragmented as the one in the United States. And I say, well, fair point. Let's look at some of the micro data. In the United States right now, 25 states plus the District of Columbia have house price inflation in excess of 10%. 40 of our major metropolitan areas, 40, have house price inflation over the past year in excess of 20%. So yes, this is an aggregate number, but if you bore into some of the detail, actually the characteristics of the regional and local housing market are far more ominous than shows up in a chart like this. I would estimate, based on that regional and local breakdown that I gave you, somewhere around 60-65% of America's housing stock is now rising at bubble-like, unsustainable rates. And that is a very dangerous phenomena for a U.S. household sector that believes in the sustainability of these asset values as a store of saving and purchasing power. Moreover, it is a worrisome development because of the nature of the indebtedness that has been laid on to monetize the asset appreciation in extracting the equity to use to support current consumption. On the left, you see the stock, the darker line of household indebtedness. That's risen 20 percentage points of GDP over the last 5 years alone, equaling the increase that occurred over the preceding 20 years. Now, a lot of people say, don't worry about the stock of debt. Worry instead about the ability of American households to service the debt. And at low levels of interest rates, debt makes a lot of sense. Again, one of our central bankers, who shall remain anonymous, but who's retiring in 11 days, made that point repeatedly during in congressional testimony in the last few years. So look at the lighter of the two lines here. This is the Federal Reserve's own series of debt service expenses relative to income. It is at a record high, even with market interest rates still at their conundrum-like low. So we have a pretty serious debt problem on our hands at low market interest rates. And again, these are the consequences of the asset economy, where American consumers continuing to up the ante on their spending posture at a time when the asset that's underpinning that bet has gone into bubble-like proportions, and interest rates are near, close to record lows. That's a precarious place for the consumer to be. It's also a precarious place for the U.S. to be in the broader world economy, and that's the chart that shows up on the right. This is where you sort of link it back into the imbalance concept that I introduced at the outset. The solid line is America's national savings rate. Net terms means stripping out depreciation. I want to show you, and by national savings, I mean the combined savings of individuals, businesses, and the government sector, which chronically runs huge budget deficits, as you know, in the United States. By net, I want to show you the savings that's left over to fund the growth in our productive capacity capital stock after we've allowed for the obsolescence of worn-out assets, and there isn't any. We're running a negative national savings rate in net terms for the first time in our recorded economic history. And so, lacking in domestic savings, we must import surplus savings from abroad in order to grow and run massive current account and trade deficits to attract the capital. It's that simple. This is basic macro. And you know, there's a lot of the critics of this will not even go into the savings investment framework. To me, this is one of the ironclad axioms of macro that clearly puts the U.S. And the rest of the world, I think, on fairly shaky footing. There's a lot of discussion about these days about trade frictions, huge bilateral trade deficits with China. I get called down to testify in front of the U.S. Congress on the so-called China problem. And the congressman asked me, they said, well, you know, you're telling us that you don't blame China because this is an outgrowth of a shortfall in national savings. I say, yes, sir. And they said, well, who do you blame? And I say to the congressman, I blame you. And they said, well, how can you say that? Because you're running these irresponsible policy of open-ended fiscal deficits, and you are also setting policies that encourage consumption over saving in the personal sector. If you were to fix America's, take actions to fix America's savings problem, these bilateral tensions with anybody would begin to dissipate. In this construct, if you close down trade with China, the deficit would just go somewhere else. And some of the congressmen actually understand that. Most of them do not. These are not our brightest people. But some of them actually do. But it's very popular to always find the scapegoat to blame someone else. So in essence, this is America's problem. It's a tough problem. And it's a problem that there's probably no painless way out. We like painless ways out. But it does entail, at the end of the day, efforts that will be required to raise our national savings rate. And to do that, we'll have to raise both our government savings rate, the budget deficit has to go from deficit to surplus, the personal savings rate will have to go back into positive territory, and it may have to take the bursting of this property bubble to take the personal savings rate back into positive territory. As long as the housing market remains in its sort of current bubble-like state, there will be little incentive to save out of current income. So that's the U.S. Just a, some thoughts here on China, because as I pointed out to you earlier, I think the Chinese economy is also in need of an important transition, and as the driver on the supply side of the global economy, I think it's equally important to focus on some of the issues that China must address. Let me just state at the outset that while I do have a reputation for being a little bit on the negative side of the U.S. economic outlook for the last few decades, I've been very constructive in my view of China for quite some time, and I still am, but I do think the Chinese leadership faces some formidable problems. And it shows up in a structure like this that tries to lay out the sources of growth of the Chinese economy. And China's been a 9 to 10% grower, especially for the last 5 years, and especially on the basis of newly revised statistics that the government has put out, not all of which I think are all that well done, but they do give a fairly accurate approximation of both the overall growth rate as well as the sources driving the growth rate. The two sectors that are driving China are on this box on the right here. Fixed investment and exports, two sectors that collectively make up, depending upon the metrics you use, roughly 80% of Chinese GDP. They're still growing at about a 30% year-on-year rate. It's just an unbelievably powerful dynamic from these two sectors. These lines are going up, as you can see, almost vertically. And I would argue that we are at the point of unsustainability. If China continues to push ahead on the fixed investment sector to the degree it has in the last 4 to 5 years, the outcome will be excess capacity and deflation. And there's already some talk inside of Beijing of precisely that concern. Moreover, if China were to keep pushing on exports, the lighter of the two lines, to the extent they have in recent years, the outcome will be heightened trade frictions and ultimately protectionism. And so China must begin to migrate away from a growth model that is pushing the structure of its economy dangerously to excess. And so what it needs to do is move to focusing more on private internal consumption, the graph on the left. And you can see on this basis what a dramatic contrast China is with the United States. America consumes to excess, and the consumption share of Chinese GDP last year fell to a record low of 43%. We're at 71, China is at 43. And I think that is going to be a huge challenge for the macro managers of the Chinese economy, because as former central planners, they're very adept at resource mobilization, which gives them the export and the investment-led growth dynamic on the right, but they don't really understand what it takes to build a thriving and sustainable consumer culture. And in the case of China, this is going to be a challenging, long-tailed evolution. I think there'll probably be two things that the Chinese need to focus on from a macro perspective to begin to build this consumer culture. One, very importantly, putting a safety net under the Chinese workers who are scared and insecure about job and income prospects due to the ongoing massive layoffs in their state-owned enterprise sector. China's still reducing headcount in its state-owned enterprise sector by 5 to 6 million workers per year. And there are a lot of workers outside the so-called SOE sector that are fearful that they may be next. And to put a safety net, that means things like Social Security, pension, unemployment insurance, retraining. At best, China has pilot projects going in each of these areas, nothing that really deals with these problems of worker insecurity. And as a result, the Chinese household sector has a very high motive for precautionary saving. And the second thing that that is needed for the development of a Chinese consumer culture is the need to uncover new sources of job creation. China's got two manufacturing sectors, the state-owned manufacturing sector, which is being dismantled and is very inefficient, and the newly privatized manufacturing sector, which is more vibrant, which is smaller, which is growing rapidly, but net-net manufacturing jobs are being reduced in China. I think China will find that the answer will probably lie in a services sector. China has one of the smallest services sectors of any major economy in the world. Under the terms of WTO accession, over the next 3 to 5 years, a number of foreign multinational service providers will be entering Chinese markets, and that may be a help. But again, these types of developments, whether it's services, job creation, the safety net of Social Security, unemployment insurance, and the like, this is a long-tailed event, and the pressures on investment and exports are more short-lived. So the point here is that not only is the American consumer at risk, but you can't count on the Chinese growth dynamic to continue to drive the world economy as it has. And the final point I'll show you on this chart is the lighter of the two lines, the export share of GDP. You can see how that's just climbing vertically. Keep in mind, as I said earlier, 35% to 40% of Chinese exports go directly to the United States. In the event of a shortfall of U.S. consumer demand, which I do think is a distinct possibility this year, China's most rapidly growing sector will clearly be at risk. Now, those are some of the tougher issues that the world has to face on a near-term basis. The title did say dark clouds and silver linings, and I want to show you a few very important silver linings. And this sort of sets the global consumption challenge in a perspective here. You see consumption shares of GDP, current ones for the U.S., Europe, Japan, China, and I put India in there. Over the next 3 to 5 years, I do see a significant realignment in the mix of global consumption as the U.S. consumption share of its GDP comes down, at least back down to the 25-year trend of 67%, possibly lower than that, and those in Europe and Japan and especially China begin to rise. India has a surprisingly high consumption share, and I think this does reflect the emergence of India's middle class and an increasingly powerful consumption story in India. If anything, I see India's consumption share actually dipping down a little bit as India focuses some of its energies on fixed investment, in particular infrastructure. The realignment of global consumption will be matched by a comparable shift in the mix of global savings. The U.S. savings rate will finally begin to move back up, and savings rates will go down in China, Europe, possibly even Japan. The good news is that if you look at these economies by their so-called purchasing power parity weights in world GDP, that the U.S., while it's the biggest economy in the world, when you add up all the other economies that need to raise consumption levels, this shift in the mix is a net plus for global consumption. They're a much larger weight of the world needs to raise consumption than the weight of the U.S. And moreover, I would argue that the upside to non-U.S. consumption is bigger than the downside to U.S. consumption. Capital spending, there's been clear globalization trends. Excuse me. There have been important globalization trends in capital spending as well. These are current dollar estimates, snapshots, 2 years, 2000, 2005, all in dollars. Therefore, there's some currency distortions here, which in particular affect the Japanese and the European movements between 2000 and 2005. The bottom line is that on a dollar basis, the real driver of global CapEx has, of course, been in China. China's come from nowhere to a near dominant position in the global capital spending sweepstakes in the last 5 years alone. It's just an absolutely extraordinary transformation. And when you add up all of these various countries, and include Canada to get this on a G5 basis and throw in China on the right-hand side, you can see that actually as a share of the collective GDP of the G5, capital spending is now above its a peak in 2000. A lot of people feel that the world is going to move into a super capital spending cycle right now. I think the odds of that are relatively low in the context of the trend on the right, but I certainly do believe that if there is a capital spending dynamic for the global economy in the years ahead, it has been and will continue to be located in China. The cross-border arbitrage of globalization, whether it's labor or capital, sees multinationals allocating their scarce resources toward low-cost production platforms, and China has been a clear beneficiary of that on the on both sides of the input equation, labor and capital. The final point is just to get into the the thorny issue of globalization in the context of global rebalancing. I know for those of you who are card-carrying economists, every morning the first thing you do when you get up is swear allegiance to the doctrine of free trade and trade liberalization. You are told, of course, that globalization is the ultimate win-win for the world economy. No matter where you are, where you work, who you are, you will all win. It's a great theory, and I think over the long run it is probably applicable. The question is, how long is the long run, and will any of us be around to see it? And the models that this win-win concept of globalization work, sort of classic Ricardian two-sector models, tradables in one sector, non-tradables in another sector, in the modern-day incarnation, it makes a good deal of sense for high-wage, rich, mature, developed economies to trade away their market share in tradables, get cheaper manufacturing goods in return that benefit the entire society, and meanwhile provide production, income, and wages for poor people who transform themselves into consumers. And not only do you in the developed world get cheaper things, but you get new consumer markets to sell things into. It is the ultimate win-win. Who could ask for more? Well, the problem is Paul Samuelson showed actually in his, 2 years ago, in sort of a stunning critique of the Ricardian model of comparative advantage, that when you introduce a hugely disruptive technology into the theory, and the internet qualifies, I think, as the most disruptive technology in modern economic history, that the answers don't always fall out as the theory of comparative advantage would lead you to believe. And what happens here is that the internet accelerates dramatically the arbitrage in tradable goods by enhancing the logistics of supply chain management in ways that we never dreamt possible. But even more importantly, it moves the arbitrage into the sector that theory told us we would be shielded from, into non-tradable services. And so 5 years ago, when we initially had this outsourcing debate, we were talking about in the developed world losing jobs in call centers and data processing. Courtesy of the internet, literally 5 years later, the job losses migrated sharply up the value chain into areas like software programming, engineering, design, doctors, lawyers, accountants, actuaries, financial analysts. Recently, I found out when I went to visit our outsourcing group in India that I had three economists working for me that I never even heard of. And so the model, the two-sector model, where as a developed economy, you compete in tradables, but you're shielded in non-tradables, the barriers get broken down because of this disruptive technology. Globalization has a lot more in the way of rough edges than the win-win paradigm would lead you to believe. And so the question you have to ask yourself, excuse me, I apologize. The question you have to ask yourself, as we do in this chart, where you can see the Chinese growth dynamic is driven dramatically by industry in India. It's driven in an almost unprecedented fashion by services. If India is to services as China is to manufacturing, what about us? And you know, this is the us in terms of America, which is jobs and income all on the wane. This is the job share of the private economy, the manufacturing share of the total economy at the end of last year fell to about 10%, which is probably about 10% more than you have in the UK. But clearly, the erosion has been powerful in tradable goods, and I would argue to you, as this final slide sort of sums the whole thing up, that it's not just a tradable goods story, but increasingly it's non-tradables. And what does that leave the rest of us to do but to continue to extract equity from overvalued assets to fund the overly indulgent consumers in the Western world? Is this the way to run the world? So that's sort of my message, John, in terms of the global economic outlook and the construct of the imbalances that continue to build as we speak. I do not think this is a sustainable outcome for the world economy by any stretch of the imagination. The burden of proof is on me in terms of the financial markets, not just me. I don't want to take this too personally. But for those of us who are wedded to the idea that ever-widening current account deficits tied to ever-falling national savings rate is a serious danger sign for any major economy, this could be a very interesting and potentially tough year in world financial markets. So let me stop at that point, and we have plenty of time for questions. You want me to sit down and do that? Or?
By all means, Stan. I thought I would open the questions for this evening by picking up on Stephen Roach's remark that the Chinese only had a pilot project in some areas. I was reminded of a Western consultant who went 20 years ago to China and was discussing how to set up new small enterprises. And he asked the Chinese, well, how many will we set up as the pilot project? And the Chinese said, we thought we would begin with 1 million. The floor is open. Yes?
Hello, I'm James Sproul. I'm an economist in the city. You've pointed out that the U.S. consumers have been addicted to a lot of mortgage equity withdrawal, something that the U.K. consumer has also found pretty addictive in the last few years, and the danger of that. Of course, there's another danger as well, which you haven't touched upon, and that's that the Chinese have put all of the vast amounts of money that they've got into U.S. Treasury bonds when the dollar is sitting at an all-time high. If I were an asset manager in China, I'd be pretty nervous about my current asset position. It could well be that a lot of the Chinese have done the last 10 years is to give away a lot of goods to the U.S. as the dollar is going to decline in the next few years, as you probably expect, and so do I.
The Chinese are nervous about that. The Chinese, however, are most nervous of all at all times about the perils of social stability. And so for them, it's a trade-off between sort of keeping the population happy and doing dumb things with their portfolios of assets. And they have repeatedly elected to be massively overweight dollar-denominated assets. The problem is, given the nature of the Chinese savings structure, given the growth dynamic that I laid out to you that's so heavily export-skewed, that they're now building up official foreign exchange reserves at a rate that we've never seen. China has gone from nowhere to now having over $800 billion of official foreign exchange reserves. They will surpass Japan this year as the world's largest repository of official foreign exchange reserves. Roughly, we think, between 70 and 75% of those reserves are held in the form of dollar-denominated assets. And this is a huge overweight given America's share in world GDP of less than 30%. Your point is well taken. In the event of a dollar decline, depending upon the magnitude of the dollar decline, this is a huge mark-to-market fiscal cost for a still poor country like China. Moreover, for China to sort of keep the music playing, in other words, to keep their currency relatively undervalued, it's risen all of 2% in the last decade, they must recycle an inordinate amount of those reserves back into dollar-denominated assets each year to keep the renminbi from rising sharply. And to do that, though, without having a major impact on its domestic economy, they must sterilize those dollar purchases. Lacking in a well-developed internal debt market, sterilization is very difficult and incomplete. And so what happens in that context is excess liquidity leaks back into the Chinese financial system, and that causes asset inflation, which I think is the root cause of the property bubble in coastal China right now. So a lot of people talk about this perfect symbiosis between China and America. It's a symbiosis that's fraught with peril on both sides of the equation. But from the Chinese standpoint, the stability objective is key.
Second question, right in the back.
Hi. I'd just like to ask you about the what you think about the alternative hypothesis for the current environment. Coined as the Bretton Woods II system, where it's thought that America is the consumer and China is the kind of lending periphery, pursuing export-led growth, and happy to accept dollar-denominated debt, paying low rates of interest, wants to keep the growth going. And the support for that being your pictures with the Chinese personal consumption percentage of GDP not really rising at all, and the percentage of export GDP going almost exponential. Perhaps that could support the idea that the current system is sustainable for the next 40, 50 years even. And the other thing being that the point that's been mentioned, that the central banks are now in an interesting prisoner's dilemma where they cannot allow the US currency to depreciate lest they lose value on their foreign reserves. And so the dollar depreciation, which will allow a current account deficit to occur, to be brought back into balance, cannot occur. What do you think about this possible long-term, long to medium-term, sustainable high current account deficit?
It's rubbish. Look, the idea that we have this newly symbiotic relationship that can exist in perpetuity, that's a question that I just attempted to address and tell you that from the standpoint of Chinese foreign exchange reserve management practices, there are huge risks in terms of incomplete sterilization and a mark-to-market loss on their overweight dollar position associated with that, number one. And secondly, the politics of the symbiotic relationship don't fly in Washington, D.C. There's probably 14 pieces of legislation that are in the legislative process right now that would slap some type of tariff on Chinese products. And whether it's rational or not is not the point. There's a very compelling political case that many populist U.S. politicians have made to go after China. What is symbiotic about that? What is sustainable about that in the context of Bretton Woods II? And on the other side of the equation, the idea that American consumers can continue to spend well in excess of income and to have those practices in large part subsidized by capital flows from Chinese central banks into our fixed income markets is a highly risky endeavor, in large part because it's not stable. The longer our labor income growth remains below sustainable longer-term average and the higher our consumption share remains relative to its norm, we're in a situation of an ever-deepening negative personal savings rate, which means we're going to be asking the Chinese to pick up more and more of the tab. There's nothing stable about their overweight and dollar-denominated assets. And finally, I would say, the rest of the world's figured this out. The rest of the world doesn't want to play. If you're a Korean central bank, a Japanese central bank, or other large holders of official foreign exchange reserves, you know what's going on. You know this is not going to end well. You are going to begin to underweight your dollar exposure positions. And I talk to central bank managers all the time, and believe me, this is exactly what's on their mind. And that will leave China, to use an American expression, holding the bag. They're going to have to go more and more into this dollar overweight bet. This is a dangerous place for China to be. Bretton Woods, too, as I said, rubbish. You're right about the prisoner's dilemma for central banks. Central banks have in large part created this monster, and the biggest culprit in that regard is our own central bank, the Federal Reserve. When they had a chance to go after the asset bubble in 1997 after Alan Greenspan proclaimed the U.S. stock market to be irrationally exuberant, they backed off, largely for domestic political reasons. And then Greenspan made a huge policy blunder by transforming his role into a cheerleader for the new paradigm, sending, I think, a strong message to speculators and other investors that it was okay to bet on the equity bubble. And when that didn't work out so well, he had no choice but to ease aggressively and create another bubble. And this one's a much bigger bubble. How do central banks get out of that? That's a fair point.
Next question, up on the top. There is a microphone, I believe, up top. Okay, carry on.
Again this year. Oh, sorry. Hi. I hope everyone heard what I said just now. So just continue that the Chinese government is going to make currency appreciate and make it more flexible this year. But because all we know that the current global imbalance problem is created by the American government internally, do you think in the long run or the medium run, what's appreciate Chinese currency influence to Chinese economy and to the global economy? And apart from this question, I'm going to add one. Because we know that after this month, Greenspan will leave the Federal and Ben will be in charge of the power. Do you think to his position, what he should do to curb the bubble problem, the housing bubble problem in the United States, and to solve this current account deficit problem as well? Please, thank you.
Well, let me ask you, answer the second one first. Bernanke is very clear in saying that he does not believe that it's appropriate for monetary policy to target asset prices. If there's one thing he is most passionate about, and this goes back to his study of the Depression of the 1930s, is that the Fed, in his view, made a major mistake in managing the U.S. economy in the context of an asset bubble, and he does not want to repeat that. So don't count on him to do that. He's passionate about two things in life: the role of monetary policy in dealing with asset bubbles and inflation targeting. And since he has no inflation to target, he's going to focus on this asset bubble issue. It's not going to get any better with him. In terms of the RMB, it is not appropriate that China shape its currency value in the context of a bilateral trade imbalance. It has to set the currency with respect to multilateral trade balances. With China now running an increasingly larger current account surplus, it is certainly appropriate for the world to put collective pressure on China to raise the currency value somewhat. The 2% move of July 21st of last year simply tells you that China recognizes the point, but most emphatically wants to go slowly. Given some of the fragility that still exists in its financial system. I think that point's well taken. I think there will be pressure on China to continue to adjust its currency upward. It may move a little bit more this year than it did last year, but not by a dramatic amount, and not by enough to satisfy the China bashers in the United States Congress. And that continues to concern me.
But definitely we know that the Chinese exports, the majority of Chinese people grow up in increase their spending, they still keep high saving rates. Therefore, one of the engines of the economy, the global economy, will slow down. And this may have large negative impact to the global economy.
I would say that Chinese exporters compete on lots of terms, and the currency is only one of them. And this last year's 2% move did nothing. And if the Chinese were to move twice as much this year, I don't think that would have a major impact either.
Question right at the back downstairs.
Based on the doomsday scenario that you've outlined this evening, where do you see stability for investment in the future? And would economies such as India and Brazil that have a huge growing population be such countries?
Doomsday is one possible inference that you could take from this. I would prefer to simply call it rebalancing, which could proceed at a gradual pace, could proceed at a disruptive pace. The risk of an unbalanced world is you could have a disruptive adjustment given the degree of the imbalances that have existed. As I look around the world, though, I actually see a fair amount of structural improvement now getting underway in Japan. I see some getting underway also, surprisingly, in Germany through labor market, improved labor market flexibility, corporate emphasis on IT spending, and through a pickup of corporate M&A-led restructuring activity in Germany. Very similar in many respects to what we're seeing in Japan. Those would be two important sources of stability. I'm also very encouraged by what I've been seeing in India recently, and I think the new Indian government initially I think their approach was somewhat disconcerting. You have the old reformers coming in, but in the context of a coalition that includes important communist elements to it, and it looked as if the old reformers were going to back down on their previous aggressive stance to opening up the Indian economy. In the last year, however, there have been very encouraging signs on the reform front. Privatization, as well as opening up a number of closed sectors to foreign direct investment. I was in India just 6 weeks ago and met with the senior leadership of the economy and really walked away feeling much more constructive about the Indian economy than I had right after the political surprise of nearly 2 years ago. The India-China comparison that everyone likes to make, in one respect, China is just one hands down with the infrastructure, the foreign direct investment. I mean, China gets $50 to $60 billion a year for the last 5 years. India gets, in a good year, five. And China's got twice the savings rate that they can plow back into infrastructure and investment that India has. But India's got at least 25 to 30 world-class companies, well-developed capital markets, a fully functioning banking system, the rule of law, and something very precious called democracy. China has none of that. Who wins the next phase? So I'm very intrigued by India. Brazil, though, I'd be a little bit more concerned about, because Brazil's new sort of major customer is China. China, in turn, is hooked on the American consumer. Should there be a U.S. consumption adjustment, that would impact China Brazil.
Yes, right here.
Well, continuing with the doomsday scenario now in the currency markets.
You guys like this doomsday stuff.
Well, how do you see the emerging market currencies, possible balancing of the dollar by a hard landing, for example, Brazil or other Latin American countries?
Look, this does worry me, and You know, pick up The Economist this week. There's one of their lead editorials in a major story about the fact that emerging markets have finally come into their own. That the golden era of emerging markets is at hand, and by the calculation done by the staff of The Economist, that the share of global GDP going to the developing world or the emerging world is now back up above 50%, returning that share to what it was, I don't know, 75 to 100 years ago. There's been a lot of reform. They're not running current account deficits anymore. Shift in currency regimes, less reliance on short-term floating rate debt. All the things that got the developing world, especially Asia, into trouble in the late 90s have been successfully dealt with, and so it is this golden era. I mean, it sounds great, and yet I do worry. Maybe I'm just too cynical. I've been too burned by periodic emerging market crises in the past. What usually happens in the emerging market area is that the crisis comes, and the post-crisis fix is very much focused on avoiding the problems that led to the most recent crisis, and it misses the next crisis that's out there. What does worry me about the so-called next crisis in the developing world is that most of these growth models are still very much supported by external rather than by internal demand, and that's very much dependent on the sustainability of the U.S. consumer. Should the U.S. consumer go, China's in trouble through NAFTA linkages, Mexico's in trouble through supply chain linkages, the rest of Asia, including Japan, becomes at risk, and so does Brazil. You know, until I see the emerging market paradigm stress tested by a shortfall in U.S. consumption demand, I'm not ready to declare that there's a new world order for the developing world that ushers in a period of unbridled prosperity and sustainable growth. It may happen, and it'd be a wonderful thing for the global economy, but I don't think the transformation has been that dramatic in the short span of about 6 or 7 years.
There's another question here.
Marcus Patton, you've titled your presentation Rebalancing. What are you rebalancing towards? What's the vision for what we should be doing in terms of running the planet?
I took that chart out because nobody had really asked me that question in a long time, and I get so many charts in this thing that it just gets unwieldy, so I put this cartoon in instead. But what I'm looking for is a world, and perhaps this is too ideal, where countries in large part are contributing their fair share to the global growth dynamic. So the U.S., for example, over the 1995 to 2002 time frame, accounted for about 98% of the cumulative growth in world GDP at market exchange rates, which includes a currency effect. And over that period, the U.S. share of world GDP averaged about 30%. I'd rather see the U.S. share go down, back down to about 30. And by the way, in the last 3 years, it's moving in the right direction. I'd rather see Japan, which has accounted for virtually no growth in world GDP and market exchange rates, dollar-based, over the past 15 years. Japan needs to raise its share to about 8 or 9%. Europe needs to raise its share to about 20%. It's been contributing about half that. So the balanced world means that if you look at the various weights of world GDP, the growth dynamic layers in very neatly with the share of global output. We have not seen that in a long, long time. And in doing that, if that's where we're headed, then almost by definition, the disparities between current account surpluses and deficits would then begin to narrow.
Crisis or this emerging crisis in the two trading blocks of sort of China versus the U.S. actually teaching central bankers around the world and policy setters that this is the kind of world they have to establish versus one of sort of national programs which largely ignore international responsibilities, perhaps in terms of global fiscal balance?
Yeah, that's a very, very important question, and that has to, you know, really It raises the key issue of the role of monetary policy in an increasingly integrated global economy. Do we have policy coordination? Do we have a financial architecture that is really commensurate with the globalization of our capital markets and the world economy? The answer to that is no. We experimented with a policy, the coordination of monetary policies twice in the 1980s to deal with the so-called dollar problem on the upside and then again on the downside. And there's very little appetite for policy coordination today. The IMF and World Bank as the two twin pillars of our post-World War II Bretton Woods architecture have not been put in a position to really function in a fashion that's commensurate with what we need in a role of policy coordination to deal with globalization. So the financial architecture really does fall short. What central banks are implicitly saying, not explicitly, is that the best global monetary policy is a collection of the best sort of national monetary policies. And I'm not sure that's correct.
Yes, right at the back.
To ask you about rebalancing, what would be the role of the countries in Eastern Europe, Turkey, Africa in this scenario?
Well, Eastern and Central Europe, the role is pretty clear. What Asia is to North America, Eastern and Central Europe certainly is to what is to Western Europe. Very important pools of human capital, potentially talented workforces with admittedly antiquated production facilities that are in the process of being modernized. This is an important element of the pan-European supply chain that through EU enlargement is being integrated into the developed world. Africa, it remains on the outside looking in. It's a great tragedy for the world socially, politically, and economically.
Yes, over here.
Thinking of the trigger for this rebalancing, do you think that soaring energy costs would go some way to do this? Do you think that a spike in energy would, I suppose I'm thinking of, you know, China becoming a greater and greater consumer of oil. They need to consume it to make the stuff, and we'll need to consume it to use it. Is that the trigger that'll help bring it around?
It could be. I mean, here's the theory in a nutshell. When you stretch an economy relative to income, relative to assets, or both, the vulnerability level rises. The ability of I think I said this at the outset, of an unbalanced economy to withstand periodic shocks, it has been significantly curtailed relative to that of a sounder or more balanced system. So in the case of the U.S., for example, short of income, as I showed you in one of those graphs, and with the wealth effect beginning to top out, you get an energy shock as we had last fall, and perhaps we're having again now. Post-Katrina, you have an immediate response by the American consumer. Personal consumption growth in the United States in the fourth quarter of 2005, number has yet to be released, the growth rate was close to zero. It's a very quick response. Get another energy shock, and you'll have another zero. You put a few zeros together for a consumer that has been growing at 3.5% for a decade, that's a tough blow for the global economy and for the U.S. economy. And energy has the clear potential to do that. Energy also does, as you said accurately, bear critically on the Chinas and Indias of the world, which consume twice as much oil per unit of GDP as the rest of the world. But, you know, economics is not good, at least macro, is not good in identifying the trigger. What macro is best at is sort of laying out a framework that tells you if you're in a stable or unstable equilibrium or disequilibrium. When you reach that conclusion, then the impact of those periodic shocks, whether it's through, you know, war, natural disaster, oil shocks, shocks in trade policy or the like, then you can assess those impacts in a different context. And so I would have to say that one of my greatest shortcomings as a macro forecaster is to call the exogenous shock. What I like to think is one of my greatest strengths is to lay out the framework to be able to understand and interpret those shocks.
There was another question over here.
What policies would you like to see implemented by governments and central bankers in order to redress the balance?
Well, I think the policies should be seen in the context of a sort of a global saving agenda. I'd like to see America adopt a pro-saving policy agenda, which would mean to reduce the government budget deficit and to put in place tax policies that would alter the relative price between current and future consumption that would be pro-saving. And conversely, I'd like to see the saving surplus economies put in place policies that would stimulate internal private consumption and reduce excess savings. So I don't have a detailed policy agenda for the entire world. It would be rather audacious for me to do that. But I think the savings lens is the place that you need to look in the United States to run the world's largest economy with the lowest national savings rate in recorded history is unconscionable. And I think that is a clear and urgent issue that must be addressed in Washington. There doesn't seem to be much appetite for it because it would have rather painful implications. And our politicians, if they're clear on one thing, it is clear their desire not to impose any pain on the American worker.
Well, that's an excellent note on which to end, I think. And thank you very much, Stephen, and thank you all for coming.